Right, okay, so this is actually a slight change from the advertised talk, which was going to be on short burst, but thinking about it a bit more carefully, this fits, I think, better into the general framework of this meeting. So this is some work that's been going on for a while now on comparing the properties of the host galaxies of GRBs and then of core collapse supernovae. I'm trying to look for similarities, differences between them. This is work in which the main culprits, myself, Andy Fruchter, Lou Stolgen, who has worked a lot on the supernova sample, and Paul Vreeswijk, who did a lot of the early work on the gamma ray burst hosts. So, jumping straight in, sort of several of the open questions that people have thought gamma ray bursts might be able to address. So, the first question is, to what extent do GRBs trace universal star formation? Now, of course, the star formation rate is another one of the issues which is hugely controversial. Any of the methods you choose to use, be it Lyman break galaxies, submillimeter galaxies, H-alpha surveys, and whatever, all have order of magnitude corrections in them to go from your observed quantities to your star formation rate. It was initially hoped, perhaps back in the late 90s, that GRBs would be a very clean way of doing this, that you could just go from your GRB rate per unit redshift into your star formation rate. I think it's now pretty clear that that's hopeless. But there is still an issue as to what extent the GRBs trace star formation as a whole. The big debate which we've had over the course of this workshop has been, what are the biases for GRB formation? Now, the big one of those biases is metallicity, which there has been much discussion on, both for and against low metallicity. A third issue, which GRB hosts are very, potentially very useful for, is what's the fate end slope of your luminosity function? So even if you can't use GRBs for this first item, you have this question of whether you can use them to measure the contribution of faint galaxies to your luminosity function. So when you want to do when you want to do your star formation rate from, say, Lyman break galaxies or something like that, you have to make this extrapolation of what your luminosity function is at the faint end. Because whenever you look in these deep surveys and try and find galaxies, especially when you try and find galaxies at a given redshift, you are flux limited. And especially if you want spectroscopic redshifts, you're flux limited quite bright. Okay, so you don't really know what the faint end slope of the luminosity function is. GRBs potentially give you a way around this because you have a bright afterglow shining through your host galaxy. You can take a spectrum of that, and so you can get the redshift and the magnitude of galaxies which are hopelessly faint. You would never pick them out even as Lyman break galaxies. And so there are a couple of examples of these things. There is one where we even know the metallicity of a galaxy, which is at R of 28, and another one where you know redshift of a galaxy which is not seen by HST to 29.5 magnitude. And so that's potentially how GRBs can tie into this first issue. And then, of course, on a theoretical viewpoint, there is this issue which there was some discussion of in a session that Philip Popczyglowski led, whether these GRBs are massive single stars, as is pushed by some camps, or whether they're some kind of exotic binary. And so that's another issue that is perhaps better addressed from a theory standpoint. So what we've done, in particular, is we've compared the GRBs to core collapse supernovae. Now, you might ask, why is that a logical sample? Well, supernova should trace massive star formation at some level, and probably a better level than GRBs. You know, all stars above some limit, you can insert your number here, but, you know, 8, 10 solar masses should undergo a supernova explosion, and that's really irrelevant of the metallicity and other biases. The sample, at least the sample I'm going to describe, is subject to the same selection effects as GRB afterglows, i.e. if you really want to know where the host galaxy is, you want to study it in detail, you have to optically select. Okay, so if there is dust in the way, then there's dust in the way of your supernova and there's dust in the way of your GRBs. I have similar written in brackets here because, of course, GRBs at peak are actually much brighter than supernovae at peak, and so you can presumably see them through higher dust columns. On the other hand, I think you can count the number of good cases of GRBs where you see a clear signature of large dust extinction, you know, on the fingers of one hand. It's not obvious that GRBs are heavily extinguished, or at least the sample that I'm going to talk about. When you are going to compare these supernovae to GRBs, you need an unbiased survey. And that means that you survey a region of sky, then you go back again sometime later, a couple of weeks, and you survey it again, you difference image your two epochs, and you find all the supernova that happened. What you can't use is anything that basically searches for supernova by saying, well, I'm going to look at all the big bright galaxies in such and such a catalogue, and I'm going to do that every week, and I'm going to find all the supernovae. Because as soon as you start saying, I'm going to look at big bright galaxies, you automatically find all the supernovae in big bright galaxies, and not the ones in little puny Magellanic type things. So there are now a few things that do this. Sloan, of course, does this. Supernova Factory does it. Both of these at somewhat lower redshift. Goods can do this at high redshift, which I'll talk about in a minute. Also, the SkyMapper telescope that Brian was telling us about last week will do this in the south very effectively. We haven't really looked particularly at Sloan and Supernova Factory because they primarily select supernovae at relatively low redshift. And so if you really want to compare like with like, then you want to compare supernova host galaxies at the same sort of redshifts that you get in GLB host galaxies. Now, you can't get supernova all the way out where you can get GLB. They're just too faint. But the best we can do is this good survey, just to briefly, I believe anyone who's not familiar with it, it's a Great Observatory's Origins Deep Survey. This is basically something that used every observatory they could think of, both in the both in space and large amounts of VLT and Subaru time. But we're particularly interested here in the HST imaging. They did five epochs of imaging, roughly in BV and Z. But rather than doing this as they do things like the ultra-deep field and just, you know, trying to stare at one point for a long time, they engineered this so that although they got an awful lot of time on this big field, they did it by building it up, by tiling the entire region every 45 days. And then they could difference very cleanly between their, you know, their each epoch of imaging. And because HST has this invariant point spread function because it's above the atmosphere, you can go very deep with these difference images and you can find very faint supernovae. This time is 45 days, was really engineered to catch 1A on the rise at about a redshift of 1 and a bit. Okay, so the primary goal of this survey was to try and do cosmography using 1As at a redshift of 1.5. And to that end, it was very much designed with 1As in mind. On the other hand, of course, it picks up all the core collapse supernova as well. The SM were basically typed as being 1As or as being core collapse. There was a PEBAC program on top of GOODS, which did targeted opportunity observations of anything that looked like a 1A, so they could get a Grissom spectrum and type it properly. Unfortunately, the core collapse were just left out of that program. I think primarily it would have just been too expensive to go and get spectra of these. So the initial survey, there are 16 core collapse supernovae. There are more from a follow-up survey. So when GOODS finished, there was a follow-up survey called PANS, which is probing acceleration now with supernovae. I don't know why they made that one up. But that basically now is searching the same fields, and again, every 45 days it carry on for another year. And so I believe there's, you know, another 20 or so core collapse supernova that should be added in soon. The redshift range of this this supernova subsample is 0.3 to 1.1, not 1.1. The mean redshift is 0.6. Now, obviously, this is a lot lower than the mean redshift for gamma ray bursts, which is now, you know, 2.5 or something. Although it's somewhat closer to the mean redshift for GRBs prior to Swift, which was just over 1. But if you just cut, if you say, well, obviously we wouldn't see supernovae out beyond about a redshift of 1.1 because they have very little ultraviolet flux, so their contribution in the optical where we're searching is very small. So let's cut out all the gamma ray bursts at a redshift of greater than 1.2. They're not, you know, the like-for-like comparison we're after. And so you can say, what do you get? And it turns out basically that you get a mean redshift of about 0.6 and a standard deviation of about 0.15, which is actually very similar to the supernova sample. So we are comparing as accurately as we can, you know, supernovae and gamma ray bursts at similar cosmic epochs. Okay, so now on to the pretty pictures. So this is a mosaic of 42 GRB hosts, which as of mid-2005 when we submitted the paper, had late-time HST observations. What I mean by late-time observations is I mean observations where if you extrapolate the afterglow out and allow for a supernova, say, as bright as 1998 BW, you believe, basically, that it doesn't contribute any flux to the images that you're looking at. And I'll explain in a minute why that's important. So what you see here is you see the green crosses. They mark the positions of the bursts on their galaxies. And in the case of the green cross, it's almost always a case that you've got this position by doing astrometry with another HST image. So you've got your image when the afterglow is bright, your image where it's faded, you subtracted the two, and you get a very, very accurate position on your host galaxy. So this is less than a HST pixel in error. The circles, if I can find some, so here, for example, these are cases where you've had to go from a ground-based image to a HST image. That's obviously a lot harder. It's more tricky then to know exactly where the burst fell on your galaxy, and so this basically shows the error box associated with the position.
We should have some less light that we can see.
Can you not see this terribly well? Can you see that better?
No.
It's not terribly clear. It looks better on my screen, as ever. The people there can see it if I spin it around.
No, but I know the picture.
You know the picture, you've seen the picture.
But I don't see them on the screen.
Right, okay. Well. Okay, anyway, in some cases you can see them. So this is a circle, this is a square. Okay, you obviously need HST for this because these postage stamps are 3 arcseconds across, or most of them are 3 arcseconds across. So if you imagine blurring this with the seeing from a ground-based telescope, you could forget anything about telling where on the galaxy these things are happening. A lot of these galaxies are actually unresolved from the ground anyway. Okay, and then the visual effects bit. Okay, this is a supernova host galaxies. Okay, and I'll blink back and forth a little bit here. Okay, but one thing you'll immediately notice when you look at these galaxies and compare them with these ones, okay, if you count up the number of spirals that you can see in this sample, well, there's one fairly clear spiral here. Nothing else looks terribly spiral-like. You know, there's a few sort of disturbed things, chain galaxies, classical train wrecks, and the various things. But there's not any obvious grand design spirals in this. Oh, sorry, there's one obvious grand design spiral in this. Whereas this sample, and immediately look at and you think, well, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, so half of them at least are grand design spirals in this sample. So immediately you get some kind of hint. For some reason on this image you can see it better. So these are then, these crosshairs are the locations of the supernovae on their host galaxies. It's quite hard by eye to see, see a difference, but I'll show in a minute there's a big difference in the way they're distributed. One thing I should point out about this mosaic, this is all of the GLB hosts. This is not the cut sample. Okay, so this is not the redshift less than 1.2. This is all of them. When you cut it down, you get down to 18 hosts. This one stays in. This is at redshift 0.8. So you have 1 out of 18 versus 8 out of 16, which are grand design spirals. Okay. So one thing you can ask yourself then is, how are these transient events, these GLBs and these supernovae, distributed on the light of their host galaxies? Now, the reason that it was very important that we had these late-time images where there was no contribution from the afterglow or from the supernova is because we want to ask, what is the surface brightness of the GLB, of the galaxy, directly under the point where the gamma ray burst or supernova occurred? And what is the underlying stellar light distribution? Okay, so what we've done here, okay, you define your galaxy as to be some area, and we used S-Extractor to do this. So basically, it convolves your image with a point spread function, and then it asks, you know, where the connected pixels are. Okay, and then you look at the value of the pixel which contains your gamma ray burst or your supernova, and you say to yourself, if I order all the pixels in the galaxy from faintest to brightest, so the faintest pixel is at 0, and the brightest pixel is at 1, how many pixels are there, or how much light is there in pixels of surface brightness lower than the one that contains the gamma ray burst or the supernova? Okay, so if you're at the 50 percentile line here, half of the light is in pixels which are fainter than the one that contains a gamma ray burst or a supernovae. If you're down here, you know, at naught, you're basically, you are the faintest pixel. If you're up here at one, then you are the brightest pixel. Okay, and what you see here, you see the gamma ray bursts in blue along the bottom. So this is a histogram, the cumulative distribution. This is the individual bursts. And you see the supernovae in red across the top, again, individual bursts, cumulative histogram. And the black line, as you guess, is just the probability of getting a gamma ray burst or a supernova is proportional to the surface brightness of your pixel. Okay, so you should immediately see that these are pretty different. For a start, you have this big build-up here. You have five gamma ray bursts, which land the brightest pixels of the host galaxies. But you also have this big build-up towards the brightest end. So they're not all right on the very peak, but they're all clustering at the bright end of the distribution. Supernovae more or less look like light. So, you know, if you KS test the supernovae against the light, it's basically indistinguishable. Your PKS is about 0.75. If you KS test this line against the light, your probability is about 0.1%. And if you obviously you can do a two-tail test, so you can KS the supernova against the GLBs, and it's about 1% in that case. So they seem to be very differently distributed on their host galaxies. Now, there are various ways you can explain this. So one thing that Shri was talking about yesterday is perhaps if they're going off in the very brightest clusters. Other alternative is perhaps simply that they're the most massive and then the youngest stars. So because of the fact that you have, you know, the luminosity of your star is some high power of the mass, if you're in a rare area that's got lots of very young stars that are still, you know, 70, 80 solar masses perhaps, then you can get a lot more light out of that than you can from a cluster which is, you know, tens of mega years old, and therefore has got, they're on down to say 20 solar masses. Pardon?
Like B light or...
So, okay, sorry, so I should say. So in the case of the supernovae, it's a very uniform thing. So we've used F606W, which is, you know, green light, basically, but your mean range is 0.6, so you're using West Train B. For the gamma ray burst, we've used this F606W filter where we can, but because these observations have come from numerous different programs, sometimes the people have used F555W, sometimes F702W. So we've tried as best as we can to do the same filter set. So it's more or less rest frame B-band light that you're plotting against here.
Have you looked at this distribution for different redshift bins for the GLBs?
Yes, you can, and it looks the same in all the redshift bins, but obviously with reduced significance because you have less in your sample, but it always is steeper than the light.
There's no difference between low redshifts.
There's no difference between low redshifts and high redshifts. Okay, the other question you can ask is, well, where do these things lie in luminosity and in physical size? Okay, so what you again here have in blue, you have the gamma ray bursts, in red you have the supernovae. So this is their MV absolute magnitude. This is their 80% light radius, which is a means of getting a handle on the size. I don't think it's a perfect way of getting a handle on the size, because when you look at think of the diagram you saw, you've got these incredibly disturbed morphologies. So what a half-light radius means, who knows? But anyway, it's a way of getting a handle on the size. And for the spirals, it's quite a good way. For the GLB host, it's not clear. It's such a good way. And so what you see here is you tend to see that gamma ray bursts lie down here. They tend to be fairly faint and they tend to be fairly small. They're compact galaxies in general, whereas your supernovae have these big spirals in which are both bright and big. So what you have here, this is a KS plot of supernovae and GLBs in absolute magnitude and in size. So the PKS here, it's about 1.5%, and here it's about 0.05%. So you're seeing quite clearly that the GLB hosts and the supernova hosts look, you know, to the eye at least, very different. So that's kind of the easy bit. So that's the physical result. So these are conclusions. And so the white are the things that you can genuinely conclude, and then the red are the things that you might draw from that. So it's quite clear that GLBs and supernovae are distributed differently on their host galaxies. Okay, you might suggests that that's either because the GLBs are in the regions of the most intense star formation, so there's something strange going on inside the clusters in which they form, or you might suggest that it's because they're the most massive, youngest, brightest stars. Okay. Supernova hosts are more luminous and they are larger than GLB hosts. Okay. In the local universe, you know quite well that there's a relationship between luminosity and metallicity. So one thing you can do quite easily, you know, you can look, say, at the Milky Way, the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud, and you can see that you're getting fainter and you're getting lower metallicity. And that's a general trend that you see across the local universe. Okay? So GLB hosts are, in general, less luminous than supernova hosts. So it would naturally follow, in that case, that they're at low metallicity. But this is not a direct metallicity measure of where the GLB occurred. Okay, it's a general measure of the host metallicity, but not of the specific metallicity at the point of the GLB. And this is one of the problems when you use hosts, of course, that you never know exactly the metallicity of the star that made the gamma ray burst. What it also very clearly tells you is that GLBs are not perfect star formation rate tracers. The one slight hope, on the other hand, is that if you believe that the reason that the supernova hosts are different from the GLB hosts is because of metallicity, that as you go back in cosmic time, i.e. to higher and higher redshifts, where the global metallicity of the universe decreases gradually, then you might get closer to tracing star formation rate in general. And I'll leave it there.
But you haven't looked at the size of the GLB hosts, I mean the low redshift part of it, because you know that galaxies do become smaller.
Yes.
With the higher redshift, so comparing...
so this plot is comparing only the redshift less than 1.2.
Oh, it was... sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, I should have pointed that out.
They're still more compact.
They're still more compact, yes. So...
But like I said, this is the first original new work in this sort of thing, instead of all the wishful thinking I've heard for the last 5 or 6 weeks. Yeah. It's great work. It is. So I had a few questions that are more technical. Can you go back to the KS test,
that one?
So just nitty-gritty sort of things. One is, so let's say I have a host galaxy.
Yeah.
And then I have a certain size that I claim is the size of the galaxy. And let's say you and I differ, then I make that size larger, meaning the pixel map I use. Then I will systematically bias that histogram.
Yeah.
I mean, basically there are a lot of pixels with zero, so it will go naturally in that direction.
Yes, okay.
How does one avoid this?
Okay, so the first thing is, okay, you can draw bigger circles, but of course... So they contain very little light once your background has attracted your thing.
They change that fraction.
They change that fraction, but only a little bit, because only perhaps 10% of the light, even if you draw a much bigger pixel, you know, even if you double the number of pixels, these pixels contain virtually no light. This is fraction of light, not fraction of area.
Yeah, let me think.
So you can have lots and lots of pixels that contain very little light.
I see. Okay, it only adds to the noise, but there's no bias.
It adds to the noise, but there's not a bias.
Yeah. Then the next question I had is, how do we know those last, the entries, you know, in that bin one entries, how do we know that the GRB is still not contributing?
Okay, so there's various ways you can do that. So the first thing, of course, is you take a model of your afterglow and its decay, and you take a 1998 BW, which is probably a reasonable guesstimate. You sum them up, and then you ask, well, how bright would that have been at the point you look? And the first thing you do is you say, well, that's not really reasonable. Okay, the second thing you can try and do is you can put a point source at the position on that source, and you can start to subtract it. Okay, but then you end up with surface brightness profiles. You know, when you plot your surface brightness profile of your galaxy, it does this sort of thing. So you can take it down, and you start to see holes in the middle of the galaxy. So you're confident that if you just trace the surface brightness profile of the galaxy in, then it would lie on the peak. Okay.
It's a bit delicate, right? I mean, it's not like you have a lot of signal-to-noise ratio in this game.
No. So the main thing is the fact that you extrapolate out and you say...
Yeah, so I'm just saying, okay, I was not thinking of supernovae, because I think that's a little bit more predictive thing, but
Yeah, well, the super nebula, we actually use pre-imaging. That's one of the nice things about GOODS, because it looked first.
No, I'm talking about this.
Oh, right, this one, yeah. Okay.
You're
thinking non-relativistic.
I don't know, the shock, you know, at some point it runs into this termination thing, it
yeah.
will re-brighten up.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it would be nice to find that, I mean, follow it up. Most people, you know, there are very few GRBs that have been followed
yeah,
up.
Yeah, so I agree. So one thing to do would be to go back to these guys
it won't
now.
Undermine this result because
yeah.
the run already just even excluding the last 4 points
yes.
the result
yeah.
looks very
yeah. yeah but yeah. I agree the only way to be sure of it would be to go back say now 5 years later
yeah.
and repeat the observations. Unfortunately because STIS has died and a lot of this early work was done with STIS that's hard because you can't directly subtract your ACS from your STIS images. Well, it depends. So the significance level, in a KS sense,
yeah.
if you just do the two distributions against each other, is about 1%.
What?
1%. So PKS equals 1% that the two are drawn from the same. But of course, KS tests are not particularly a sensitive test.
Are you trying to look at the ripening of these samples?
In terms of the colours of the hosts, you mean?
No, I was actually thinking about the GRBs.
Well, the problem is, of course, right, so the GRBs themselves, in general, don't have high reddening. So if you look at the SED, you know, UBVRI, you don't, you know, you tend to see a fairly good power law all the way through. And so when you fit the reddening curve to that, it tends to be fairly small.
Always low dust. It looks like many of these galaxies, very little dust. Also.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's not always the case. And so one thing, you know, we can't say that all of these are low dust because sometimes we only have afterglow light curves in one colour or something like that.
There's no trend with redshift. So.
There is no trend with redshift in general. But again, a relatively small sample of the total has actually been well studied in that respect. So.
What about, do you have a data for 1As? Just do it the same way.
Okay, so 1As look kind of weird. And it's hard to say what they're doing. Again, we only have about 16 of them so far. 1As kind of peak up here, then they go along fairly flat, you know, with gradual slope, and then they peak up again towards the very top. So they look kind of weird.
So is it consistent with that double?
It's consistent, but it's not. I mean, you couldn't significantly claim it with the sample that we presently have.
Consistent with what?
So, I think Massimo has done some work in which he suggests that there are actually two populations of SM1A, which are one of which traces star formation and one of which is basically tracing mass.
Okay.
So, the 1A rate is, I think, 20 times higher or something in star-forming galaxies than it is in ellipticals. So, although you see these things in ellipticals, you see them preferentially. In star-forming systems.
How do you... tell me a bit more about GOODS. So you have this 45-day cadence survey.
Yeah.
Some things pop out, and then... how do you guys know it's a 1A, it's a non-1A?
Okay, so they have... they already have photometric redshifts for all the galaxies, because they have it from... they have these colours. They also have ground-based JHK. So they have photometric redshifts for all the galaxies. So they already have a rough idea of what redshift this transient is at.
Okay.
And then they compare their V, I, Z colours against templates at that redshift for 1As, 2s, 1BCs, and so on. And they look at what fits the 1A curve.
You mean there's no spectroscopic evidence at all in this game?
There is for the 1As. Okay, so things that are then identified by the colours as 1As are targeted by the ACS GRISM, which is basically because of the redshift for the 1As they're looking at, which is sort of 1.1, 1.2, it's the only game in town because you're in the skylines.
Do those photometric things pan out?
They work. So they all the things they looked at, they thought 1As were 1As.
And at the redshift.
And at the redshift, they thought. But for the 2s, it is all done
and everything
on
else
the colours.
Is called a non-1A?
Everything else is called a non-1A. Yeah, and this
so
is something...
you say collapse, you meant
anything? I meant two L's, two P's, one BC's, everything.
Could there be some 1As in your your core collapse category?
I mean, I guess it's conceivable. I think it's unlikely because they were very, very keen on picking up their 1As. They put a lot of effort into that. But if they were particularly unusual, then it's possible. I was actually talking with Pete Nugent last week about the typing, and he thinks he could probably do a better job now with his scripts that they use for SN Factory and so on than for the...
So how do the 1As differ from 1Bs if I just knew only the light curve?
Well, 1Bs are typically, I think, slightly faster. They are different color-wise as well, I'm led to believe. I can't remember exactly how Massimo can...
Well, it might depend on if the, yes, the colors are
yeah.
A good filtration. Like if the 1A is red in it, for example, it's not so good. No. If you don't have the spectroscopy, in my opinion, it's tough.
So it what that does...
I mean, the risk to be contaminated at high ratio by 1BC is not...
Which means... But the ones that he calls... Yeah. This sample is anything but 1A. That's,
yeah.
You know that.
Yeah. That's all they say. It's not. They're not. They claim, and they do try to fit reddening as well, and they claim that they're not consistent with 1As.
But now, the interpretation is really interesting to talk about. That's one of the last points.
This is absolutely the best support for the collapse evolution, and this is it. And now I'm clockboard. That's it.
This is a great moment.
So,
Andrew, can you take the bottle of champagne that you have prepared?
But still, the cluster
is
saying you brought
a serious question.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, could you talk a little more about the morphology of the galaxies that have the gamma ray bursts? Are they...
They're a mix, basically. They're...
Are they... Would there be a lot of them be classified as irregular, or just...
So a lot of them are classified as irregular, yeah, more or less. So if you look at this, you know, concentration asymmetry sort of plots, they're all over it. So there are a few, you know, there are a couple. There's this one and there's another one which comes out as a spiral. A lot of them come out as these high concentration objects, especially the higher redshift ones. They look, you know, fairly heavily centrally concentrated. Similar actually had how the Scuba galaxies look at that sort of redshift.
Yeah, can you tell how many of them are like merging events?
Actually, not so many turn out as mergers. So you've got a few. So, you know, 99.123 looks like a merger. This one looks like a merger. And this one. But they're not all merging, certainly.
Okay. Have you compared the morphology of this sample with a non-GFD sample at a similar redshift? Are they different?
So morphology-wise, they're not obviously different from faint galaxies in the HDF.
So they're not...
Certainly at low redshift. At higher redshift, they're more concentrated. So they're centrally, there's more light in the middle of the galaxies at higher redshifts and beyond 1.2 than there are in HDF galaxies at that redshift.
Does one have spectra of these bright spots on these galaxies? Do they look like Wolf Rayet galaxies?
You don't really have spectra of the bright spots because, you know, one thing, yeah, although these look very well resolved here, when you go from the ground and you put a 1 arc second slit across, you know, 1 arc second slit is that galaxy.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
So you don't have spectra of the bright spot. No.
Yeah, but you have most of the light in the bright spot. So if you take
yeah.
the spectrum, you will have
yeah.
the bright spot basically.
Yeah.
Would be great to do that if that's possible. I don't know whether.
So there are spectra. Yeah, this one in particular, there is spectroscopy of, and it comes out as a moderately low metallicity starburst galaxy.
Okay, so let's do both ways. Let's assume metallicity is the cause, okay, and go to its logical end. What does the collapse of religion have about metallicity? That the ratio of GRBs to supernovae will change dramatically with metallicity? I mean, roughly, what are we looking at?
Yeah,
can
so
you write down a function, GRB over SN is 1, sorry, Z to the N.
Well, I think for the single...
Maybe you should define, I mean, collapse our religion, I think what you really want to say is, I want to say the single star progenitor for, because progenitors,
yeah.
different progenitors have different results, but if you say Adam going to have the single star progenitor religion?
It has a cutoff.
Over Langer said the metallicity has to be below 0.1.
Yeah, and, it's not so much that it's a relationship that, you know, it goes up metallicity. It comes out and it just chops. So the claim of the collapsar.
Fine. Okay. In this particular variant, the unified church, we have the monotheistic part. Okay. Then we'll do the pantheistic. So what we have is, you're saying below, if z is less than 0.1, you get GRBs. Above that, no GRBs.
That's what Norbert was saying.
Norbert Lang says. For single star.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's go through what it means.
Here you're not sure that it's less than 0.1.
No, you don't know
exactly
what
it is. We're not fixated. Maybe it's 0.3 or 0.03, but some number which is smaller than solar. But some order.
But Chris, does that number come from having enough winds or angular momentum issue, or what's the main?
It's winds.
Well, no, it's AM as well.
It's not just winds. It's also to get the right mixing to convert the entire or most of the hydrogen envelope into helium. So in those stars, they're burning all the hydrogen into helium.
Okay.
So it's not.
Okay. So what does this mean? That what if I go to the metallicity in the mean is decreasing as I go to high redshift.
Yeah.
So at some redshift, all the explosions will be GRBs.
It's due to rotation. Which one?
Well, if you had enough rotation in the first place.
Oh wait. Okay. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand. So
yeah.
In addition to metallicity, you want rotation.
Yes, you need rotation, and you still need to get rid of your envelope. So one of the problems, I think, at higher redshift, at very low metallicity for single stars, is if you don't get rid of your envelope.
No, but not for the single star models, as well as Norbert.
Oh, because they get total mixing, don't they?
Because they get total mixing,
okay.
So they don't have any hydrogen envelope. They burn
right, off. Okay. So in that case, in that model, I guess,
but,
yes.
And so in this model, at some metallicity,
everything that rotates fast
any
enough.
Any massive star above certain mass is a GRB.
As long as it rotates fast enough to make a torus when it collapses. So there's still only some fraction, because some of them are still rotated on the main sequence.
Yeah. The majority of massive stars rotates rapidly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have this thing where...
Okay,
oh, far too many, yeah.
Okay, how about this other one, the binary thing? What do those guys have with metallicity?
Well, so they do have a, I think, perhaps Chris can say more, but they have a preference for low metallicity, but not an essential aspect. So again, because of the fact that you can lose your envelope in winds and things like this, so you lose your envelope in your binary interactions. So you have your common envelope and you throw it off, and in that process you spin up.
And then the reason you need low metallicity is you do not want to lose
too much angular momentum.
The mass of the star.
You want to. So solar metallicity. It's very hard. It gets harder to make a star end its life at massive enough to collapse under a black hole. With the binary interaction. So it's preferentially it should increase as you go to lower metallicity.
Mm-hmm. So if the metallicity is 1/10 solar, what fraction of stars collapse to GRBs? All?
Huh? What fraction? So usually the question is what fraction of stars more than 20 solar masses? Those are the black hole forming ones. 10 solar, then it's all a question of how are we getting the angular momentum in there. And so that we don't know. So we can't say numbers at all. Anybody that says numbers all hit them over the head.
But you see that most our stars are rapid rotators in our galaxy.
Yeah, but they're not
rotating.
But their cores are not rotating. You know, a single star is not rotating rapidly enough in the core to make a disk.
So how rapid should it rotate?
We need it to have enough so that when it forms a black hole, it's around 10 to the 17 centimeters squared per second in specific. And it is rotating at the outside with that angular momentum, but not in the core, because the core attaches to the envelope. And so if you did a constant omega, constant rotation rate in the star, the core is never rotating rapidly enough to So you have to somehow decouple the core from the envelope.
But that is a complication always, but also in the liner model?
No, he has a something with his low metallicity, somehow they get some models to get enough rotation. These guys have a lot of parameters. I don't know how they get around
that. Oh.
They do get there.
Yeah, but then it's very hard to say what fraction.
That's right. So because they have these, they don't understand that physics, they can get lots of answers. So it's hard to give fractions as a number.
If I got the question, you can derive from observations what fraction of supernovae, corpuscular supernovae, is able to produce energy.
How
many
do
I?
Okay,
from the rate of GRB event computed by Martin Schmidt, 0.5 event every gigaparsec per year, with scale for the, of course, for the limiting factor, and that is a bit okay. If you you can use the value defined by Iran and Batsman, that is between 75 and 100, or the Frey number is 500.
No.
You compare this, and this gives you for a Milky Way galaxy the 10 to minus, okay, I should have given you my laptop. Anyway, the bottom line is that when you compare this rate of GRB locally, rate with the Taiwan BC supernova, you find that about 1-2% of 1 BC.
So that I'm not disputing. What I was trying to understand is, we have, for all the biases, we have a GRB rate as a function of 1 plus Z. No, with the sample.
Yeah, the point is that we do not have a very reduced rates of 1 BC along the direction.
Yeah, we do have in this limited fashion here with this survey. So I want to know, is how dramatic is this ratio changing?
Yeah. I think it's a good point. You could try, and it's something you could try. It's not something I know off the top of my head, but you could look at that. Certainly when you get more core-clock supernova to compare to.
Yeah, it's a reasonable sample. It's not, you're not each sample limits the other sample, so it's not a bad situation.
Yeah. But you haven't got many 1BCs, right? This is, they're not 1As. So most of them are probably 2s.
It doesn't matter. We'll just make an approximation,
But the big question is, why do single massive stars or binaries in normal galaxies don't do this? And why do these guys in these galaxies do this? It's not a single method. No. Because you see these very massive stars also in normal galaxies.
It's
so see massive binaries also in normal galaxies, lots of overhead binaries in our galaxies.
So
why don't they make?
Because it's nothing to do with the mass of the star. That's a simple answer.
That's one possible answer.
Yeah, it's the simplest one.
It's nothing to do with the mass of the star. But it has to do with the mass of the star, because we know you now also believe in the Kolopsar model. Those are massive stars.
No one is believing that long duration bursts come from massive stars. Okay, but that's not a very useful statement. This is accepted theology, and we know that roughly 1% of them become GRB. But the question is, which 1%? One idea: the most massive end. Why not? There's a sequence: white dwarfs, neutron stars, black holes, GRBs. The other one is massive stars, but with some special thing going for them, some rotation. Okay. And what my view is that this whole metallicity thing, I think, is really confusing. It's a minor clue in this game.
No, but it could mean that low metallicity indeed has much more fast rotating stars, so a higher fraction.
Yeah. So you can choose metallicity, but it just seems to me this is entirely driven by a certain model of consideration. But I would say, so how do we choose unusual stars? I would say the simplest way to look at other other things in astronomy, unusual stars come from clusters. If we want the most unusual star binary in our galaxy, go to a globular cluster. It's very simple. You know, you'll get some stars you'll never produce in the disk because they're made in a different way, they're dynamical. So, as I was saying to Andrew yesterday, I look at this and I say, well, what it is that these are all, their GRBs are reserved for cluster factory. And they're like LMXBs. I'm just doing this an analogy. Then, if I say LMXBs, Ed goes off into this thing about they're old and really young. Of course, these are young, and LMXBs are old. I'm not disputing that. So, this, at least to me, the simplest explanation is there's some very massive star formation that takes place. There's a high density of stars, and then they bash around, create some much-needed angular momentum at the last minute or whatever. It's a rare thing. I just had to do it 1 in 100 times. And so maybe we are just seeing, instead of seeing the run of metallicity with 1 plus Z, we are seeing the run of this detailed star formation. And it's very clear, star formation now in a galaxy is distributed. Half the stars are formed, for example, in small groups. Okay. For example, TW Hydra, 50 parsecs away. It's hard even to see the star forming region, but it's young. And then the local thing is Orion, which is hardly a big star forming cluster by sort of high redshift standards, by any standards. So not only metallicity is changing, but the very mode of star formation changes with not only metallicity, but the mode of star formation itself changes as the universe evolves. Many of these galaxies are put together, those chain galaxies, you know, they must, if they're not collisions or something, obviously there's some, you know, if you could make a deeper picture, we'd probably find there's there are condensations there. They're probably all, so the reason I want to actually acknowledge the collapse, I decided today I'll write this cluster paper quickly and keep you guys busy on the whole metallicity for another week, then this would be a great strategy on my part.
what if you remade
that
plot?
Completely wrong paper.
Instead of saying, you know, here is where it lies in terms of the brightest pixel for that one galaxy, you normalize the whole thing. You said, okay, well, here's what how the B band light for say square kiloparsec for each of the objects that I see. And I don't care what
right.
galaxies they're in.
Okay, I haven't tried that. I suspect. I suspect in general that the GRBs would then lie much higher because, you know, these brightest pixels, you know, are much brighter, but it's not something I've checked. But I suspect you would see the GRBs are a lot higher in absolute terms as well as in relative
sure,
terms.
I'm just wondering if you can explain, you know, what galaxies are in and where they are just all by some threshold in the
star formation
density, or if it's got to be more than that.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. Yeah, it might work. I agree.
Yeah.
It's worth a shot. Yeah.
Yes, but you need three things to make this collapsar work. You need rapid rotation, you need the high mass to start with, and you need to get rid of the hydrogen envelope.
And
the helium envelope as
yeah,
well. So you need to get rid of, you need three conditions. Binarity can help, but I do not see very much from this picture that binaries would be involved already.
No, there's not an obvious reason why you get more binaries in your little galaxies than your big galaxies. I mean, it could be true, as you said, that the mode of star formation form changes. So things like 30 Uranus, you know, in the SMC are the most intense regions around. So you do get, you know, very intense star formation in the low metallicity things, whereas it's more spread out. And so if you did need this very intense star formation, then that might be an explanation.
Now I would like to know how many O stars would there be in one of such clump you see in this galaxy?
A lot. I mean, so the problem is that these...
There must be lots of them, otherwise you wouldn't see such a...
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, these things... So, you know, these things can be, you know, this is a few kiloparsecs across, okay? It's got a star, you know, its specific star formation rate per unit mass, it can be very high. So, yeah, there's tens of thousands of them, probably.
Hmm?
Tens of thousands of them, probably.
Tens of thousands of O stars.
Yeah.
that's a very interesting answer. That indeed something funny can happen to one of them.
Yeah.
We have in our galaxy this one cluster, a restaurant, which has all these old ray stars and everything, but it's still no comparison to these things, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know, because obviously you can't study these things on the sort of resolution that you can study, you know, nearby galaxies.
These guys are already both writing their papers now.
That's it. That's it. Please continue the work, good work on the medical city.
Thank you.